Randy, I wasn't around for last week's intro and you said really nice things about me. So if anyone hasn't heard it, they need to go back and listen. But anyway, this week, why don't we say something nice about you?
Oh, no way, Lily. If you're going to do that, I just can't be here for it. But can I say something nice about other people instead?
Okay, yeah, sure. That sounds like a good compromise. You go for it.
Okay, so I've managed to arrange my professional life around talking to lots of smart people. I mean, there's you and the lovely people on the podcast every week, but I also run a few communities for product people. I do one for CPOs and one for coaches and one for just a great group of product people.
And today we're talking to one of your lovely community members about some insight they shared with you on how they implemented continuous discovery at their B2B company and all the things they learned from doing it.
Yeah. Katie Marcus, who's a seasoned early-stage startup product leader, shared a great post that's a reflection from someone who's clearly been really in the trenches on all of this.
And it's very refreshing to hear such a real-life case study of the realities of product management, but also some great tips and takeaways to help you in your own journey. So take it away with the music.
The Product Experience is brought to you by Mind the Product. Every week on the podcast, we talk to the best product people from around the globe.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and discover loads of free resources to help you with your product practice. You can also find more information about Mind the Product's conferences and their great training opportunities happening around the world and online.
Create a free account on the website for a fully personalized experience and to get access to the full library of awesome content and the weekly curated newsletter. Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities. There's probably one near you.
Hi, Katie. Welcome to the Product Experience. It's great to be talking to you today. How are you doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Yeah, excited to be here as well. Good to meet you and re-meet Randy.
So we're going to be talking about continuous discovery today, but before we get stuck into the topic, it would be great if you could give our listeners a real quick intro to who you are and how you got into product and what you're up to now.
Yeah, of course. So I basically describe myself as a serial early stage startup product person. I've sort of found my little niche doing that. So I've worked my way around several really interesting London startups. I try and pick ones that are very kind of on mission or sort of on kind of my personal kind of interests. So I've done quite a lot of work in the sort of circular fashion space, most notably at Depop, the secondhand fashion app, a few things in the circular economy space. Lending toys to kids was one of the most fun ones at a company called Whirly. And I basically found my way into product through being a not very good product designer. And it took a boss telling me, hey, I think you're probably better suited to product management than design. So for me, that was a sort of slow transition 5 or 6 years ago, transitioned fully into product, which I'm absolutely loving to this day. At the moment, I'm very fortunate to be on a bit of a sabbatical, kind of thinking about what's next. I've done this early stage startup thing so many times. I'm sort of a bit of a reckoning point, and it feels like a very interesting time at the moment for product, I would say. Some of the sort of meta stuff going on and these new technologies coming in. So yeah, it's quite nice. Feel very privileged to be able to step back a bit and have a bit of time to think about what's next. But yeah, that's where I am at the moment.
Nice. Thanks, Katie. And our topic for this evening is based on a blog post that you wrote, actually, which we loved, by the way. And it was all about the lessons that you learned from doing continuous discovery for a quarter, presumably a quarter of time, so 3 months. So tell us about the background of where you were doing this, how you came to decide to really kind of throw yourselves into continuous discovery as a process.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was at Progression, the company that I was at most recently. They're an HR tech platform, so helping companies build out really beautifully designed career frameworks for their teams and help them grow and develop in a way that's very employee-centric. So again, a mission that was very close to my heart. I joined essentially as product person number one, and one of the sort of challenges handed to me on my plate was really like the team had sort of diverged a bit. They weren't really like, they were delivering, but not delivering value. They weren't really speaking to customers often enough. So essentially they kind of recognized there was a problem in that kind of area of discovery, you know, that a product person would typically be the person to sort of be bringing the team along with that. So that was very much the sort of mission that I was kind of handed when I joined Progression. That real kind of lack of rigor at the discovery stage, they kind of already recognized that was a problem. So it's great. I didn't really have to convince anyone. It was more like, we know there's a problem here and we'd love for you to solve it. And I think because of my design background and also some of the places I've been working at previously, I've always been very close to customers. And I think continuous discovery is essentially about being close to customers and centering them in a lot of your product decisions. So yeah, I basically just wanted to bring that sort of philosophy and practice into Progression and sort of help onboard the team onto it.
And have you used, I guess, let's call it kind of a purist, as in like by the book, Teresa Torres' continuous discovery book. Have you used that sort of process before in other places that you've worked?
Not as purist. I actually picked up the book and read it cover to cover around this time for the first time, because it's sort of funny, you sort of see all the sort of think pieces on the internet and Teresa's amazing sort of online resources. I'd read bits and pieces, but I actually did sit down and I've got the book right here, actually read it cover to cover and make a load of notes. So it's the first time I'd sort of thought about, yeah, really sort of deep diving into this and kind of adding it to my mental sort of box of tricks of product tools. So it's the first time I'd used it to the letter. Mm. But I definitely, as I was reading it, I was like, I recognize a lot of these techniques. It almost sort of cemented what I already knew in some ways and then expanded and kind of gave me a few new ideas in other ways as well.
Katie, I teach discovery sometimes. I've gone into companies and done it. I've done it at conferences and things like that. And there's a huge difference I find between what Teresa actually says and what people think she says and how they approach it. So I'm curious to dig into what you actually did, and not that I'm accusing you of not following the right way of doing it. I'm curious about what was the practical things that you did that helped you implement this. So how did you actually get started?
Yeah, really good question. And I do agree with what you've just said there. I think Teresa suffers quite a lot from people misinterpreting some of what she said. I think there was a kind of blow up recently around, you're saying that no one needs UX and research anymore. And it's like, no, in no ways does she say that. And even just going back to that sort of central principle of the book, which I have written down to remind myself, continuous discovery is a minimum weekly touch point with customers by the team building the products, where they conduct small research activities in pursuit of desired outcomes. Like, and you can just bold all of those words and just be like, you know, no one can disagree with this, you know, it's a good idea. But yeah, as I said, at Progression, you know, that this wasn't happening. You know, customer success and customer service teams were talking to the customers rather than the teams actually doing the work. So there was that kind of disconnect. And I think that's how you get into this real like handoff or sort of solutionized culture, where the team who are actually solving the problems and not the ones talking to the customer in pursuit of a desired outcome, that in itself is really important. So when I was implementing this, I was thinking, how can I make that outcome, you know, really crystal clear? Because otherwise there's the risk that these teams who this is maybe new for, they go in, they speak to customers, the customer tells them a problem, and then they go and solve it, you know, and it's kind of the outcome that the company, that kind of angle of the company. So again, when I was thinking about implementing this, I made sure that I made the desired outcome, not just for our customers, but for us as a business, like really crystal clear as well. And I think that idea of weekly touch points is really interesting as well. And I'll probably touch on this a bit later when I get into some of the challenges around B2B, and particularly kind of smaller volume, more like enterprise B2B. What do we mean by that weekly touch point? Do we mean like, you know, actual interviews, conversations, like Teresa, you know, obviously heavily leans on that, but I think also respecting that you can have that touch point with customers in like other ways as well, like thinking more laterally about how can we look at what customers are doing and like learn from them and understand how they're using our product and what their desires are without necessarily feeling overwhelmed by like 10 interviews a week with customers, which like for an introvert like me or for people who are new to research, that can be quite overwhelming. So for me, it was a mix of sort of reading these principles, but almost like reading between the lines and saying, well, how can we make this appropriate and like onboard it, you know, slowly to our team who's like new to this.
So one of the things I think you did is an OKR. And I always find that interesting in this sort of thing, because you're trying to incentivize an output rather than an outcome. But sometimes you're doing that to start to get them into that, build the habit to create the outcome. So what was the OKR that you put in place?
Yeah, so we did make sure that the OKR for this quarter explicitly did cover that idea of discovery. And we actually had a measurable objective around, you know, learning from customers and sharing back, you know, that I think we did have something like 3 to 5 research calls performed by the team every week. So, you know, it's almost like the OKR reflect the fact that we did want to commit to this. I think in the book, Teresa talks about the idea of learning goals and performance goals as separate things. So actually baking in that idea of learning and kind of building that muscle is super valid. And even discovering the right metric, you know, in itself should be a kind of discovery goal as well. So that objective that we set actually also covered the fact that we didn't necessarily know what the right goal was even. So we're kind of discovering what the right metric is. So yeah, it was as easy as that. We really did just like bake that idea that, you know, this is something we want to commit to into the objective.
And once you had that objective, what was your kind of your next step then?
I think firstly, it was just spending a lot of time making sure that the whole team was like really comfortable with it, bringing everyone together, making sure everyone had the shared understanding of what that objective was. As I mentioned in my blog post, we kind of got together in person and did this super micro mini design sprint, which was me kind of reintroducing that OKR, making sure everyone was aware of it and understood what it meant. And then actually just doing a little bit of ideation and discovery together. So I'd already gone out and spoken to quite a few of our customers because, again, being new to progression, for me, that was just a chance to sort of ramp up my own sort of foundational understanding of our customers and even like help me form, you know, what I thought the sort of strategic objective here should be. So it's me sharing back some of those learnings. It was getting everyone on the same page about what we were doing, getting them comfortable with just talking about ideas together. That was really useful. And then, we just started devolving that responsibility down to the teams themselves. So we were a pretty small product function. Like I was the sole product person. We had 2 product designers, 5 or 6 engineers, so 2 fairly lean pods. So it's basically splitting those out, making sure everyone was clear which kind of part of this they were driving on. One really cute thing we did was kind of help the pods like brand themselves. Like they kind of gave each other a name, kind of reflected what they were driving on. We made stickers, you know, some of those little things that just helps them feel like really sort of empowered and like, you know, they are the ones owning some of these problems. And then essentially we kind of tried to kick off the process together. So that was actually taking some of Teresa's book quite literally, developing opportunity solution trees together, setting a cadence for how we were going to stay in touch and kind of learn what the pods were doing and how I in particular could help, how other stakeholders in progression could be aware of what was going on in the teams. And then making sure that they were really like unblocked. So making sure that they had users to talk to all the time as well. So those were really the kind of setup activities that I was helping with.
Katie, you said you did a micro design sprint. How micro was it?
It was essentially half a day. So yeah, I can't remember how long we typically take, 4 to 6 weeks or something.
Oh no, a week in theory, yeah, is the typical one.
Yes. So yeah, it was half a day. But what it didn't do is cover the whole sort of like triple diamond of sort of zooming in and out, understanding, defining, sketching, you know, ideating, validating and so on. It was really just a little micro part of that. It was really the sort of just getting people together to like understand the problem and then start sketching out some like how might we's. And the purpose wasn't really to like solve the whole problem in one go. It was really just to get people sort of together and excited and building ideas together.
I love that. I've saw one person blog about their 2-hour design sprint approach. And I think it's a huge point. You know, we think you need to ask permission and get a whole bunch of people focused, and, you know, get permission to use them for a significant period of time. And you can get a lot of the benefit really quickly.
I think it's, again, like we were saying with the book, it's not about following it to the letter as like a sort of fresh out the box, you know, you have to follow it in this way. It's like, do what's suitable for you, you know, cherry pick the bits that work for you and your team. So it worked really well for us.
And so going into the, I guess, the business as usual daily work of implementing this continuous discovery framework, Like, how did that go? Was everyone sort of like, cool, yeah, we know what we're doing, just got straight into it and everything was smooth sailing? Or how was it?
Yeah, definitely not. So yeah, there were definitely a lot of learnings, I think, from like, it's not like we were going from zero to one. And I think it's not like, sometimes you hear there's just so much resistance from all this senior leadership to like trying a new way of working. So luckily, because we were small and lean and, you know, we have product-y founders, there was no resistance to getting going. But yeah, we set up this sort of weekly cadence because we thought, you know, in the first few weeks, we just really want to sort of learn how the teams are finding this and sort of raise early if there's any problems. But the team were definitely saying to us, like, even though they kind of ran into it really enthusiastic, felt really kind of, I think, engaged and empowered by this, we definitely got some pushback saying like, oh, this is also kind of stressing me out. You know, the typical thing of engineers saying like, we don't feel confident, you know, speaking to users, or like, we're waiting for some design work to be done before we know what to build. So definitely sort of not underestimating that sort of turnaround in like the team feeling confident will take some time for sure. I think also just realizing, yeah, the sort of the change, you know, in pace was definitely something we underestimated. So I think really like just getting that balance of like giving it some time to bed in, retrospecting regularly to sort of learn from the team what's working and not working, and then sort of tweaking and iterating and figuring out how we can best support them from there.
And you mentioned as well that because you didn't have at the time a kind of dedicated product manager within each of the pods or squads that you'd put together, that must have made things, I imagine that must have made things quite hard actually, because you don't have that then support across the whole team to say that this is okay, it's okay that you don't know exactly what you're doing, we'll find our way through it and stuff like that. And I think that's often the role of the product manager, is to coach people through feeling kind of uncomfortable and that ambiguity and everything as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting tensions actually in that issue that came up with some of Teresa's thinking recently, where she was saying, you know, it's not that everything should be owned by these sort of specialists, you know, product people, user researchers maybe are the best at, you know, focusing on outcomes and like they're the ones who know best how to research. And yes, that should be shared. But I think that tension definitely arose in our teams, probably exacerbated by the fact we didn't have dedicated product managers in each team. And then you sort of run the risk of asking, you know, designers, engineers, who obviously designers should have some research skills, but like asking them to sort of step beyond their comfort zone, definitely asking engineers to step beyond their comfort zone. I think that was a big learning of like, is it reasonable, you know, to delegate some of this responsibility to teams where we didn't have that full squad? So I think it's particularly in like leaner teams, like progression was definitely being mindful if you do want to implement something like this, you know, just having a conversation maybe about responsibilities, the team's confidence to talk to users and run this really effectively. Because to be honest, if you know, if it's delegated too fast, too soon, which maybe we did, I guess you run the risk of people feeling a bit burned out, feeling a bit unconfident, not getting great insights if you're not kind of skilled in asking the right questions to researchers, and ultimately still not, you know, achieving what you want to from this discovery process. So yeah, it was definitely a learning that like lacking those kind of full rounded product teams probably hurt us in this.
Katie, progression is a B2B SaaS. And one of the issues that's come up for me when I've talked to other people in that situation is user recruitment is sometimes really hard. Any tips, any lessons, any challenges that you found in that?
I mean, I firstly will just plus one that it is hard. You can imagine in the world of HR tech, you know, our customers are super busy. Even if, you know, we have really engaged customers who love our product, they're not going to want to talk to us, you know, weekly or monthly to sort of have us pick their brains. And progression was more on the enterprise-y side of B2B. So we're talking sort of hundreds, not thousands of customers. So the pool there is relatively small. For me, I really just took the approach of like, A, then what can we do to make it as incentivizing and simple, as frictionless as possible for our customers to give us feedback in like any form that they want. So that was kind of, we just experimented with so much stuff. We set up shared Slack channels with some of our customers where we could just throw stuff really quickly and easily back and forward. You know, we tried to pitch it as like, you get to input into what you know, the future shape of our product, and they genuinely did because we really valued their feedback. We embedded feedback directly into the product in terms of really quick feedback loops of like, what do you think of this beta feature, etc. So we tried to make it as easy as possible to engage the customers who were biting. But then the second thing we did, as I kind of mentioned at the top, was we just cast our net a bit more laterally as well. And we just said, well, all user, you know, customer feedback is good. So we kind of looked at prospective customers as well as existing customers, you know, to try and find people like that. We did a lot of asynchronous research through platforms like Maze, where you can just kind of throw up some questions or a sort of prototype and get feedback asynchronously, which worked a lot better for some of our customers than trying to get together on a call. So I think it's those two things of like really sort of reducing the friction for existing customers who we wanted to talk to regularly, and then sort of casting our net a bit more laterally, that helped us slightly circumvent some of those problems of low volume kind of customer base in B2B.
And I guess on the quant side, that would have been a challenge as well when you're not, you know, you're an early stage startup, but also you're targeting enterprise. So very hard to rely on any sort of quant data in that situation.
That was definitely one of the hardest challenges I found from the sort of doctrine set out in the book, this idea that you're kind of isolating these small opportunities that are very self-contained. You're throwing them out there as an experiment to test your assumptions. You're getting really rapid feedback loops on if it's working or not. And then you're kind of continually making this iterate, continual, quick call. When you do have that really low signal strength of like fewer customers flowing through your product, then naturally it's going to be much harder to learn really quickly and quantitatively, you know, statistically, is this thing working or not? And also with the nature of our product, you know, it's not the kind of product people would use daily. It's more like, you know, you build out your career framework, you're doing these kind of career check-ins once a quarter. Like our sort of cadence for learning was a lot longer. So yeah, I definitely struggled with some of that idea of like ship a tiny opportunity, get it out there, learn really quickly, and like decide really quickly what to do with it. That was definitely a challenge.
Katie, when you're in your next role and you're trying to implement this again, what would you do differently? What did you learn that you would try and do better next time?
I think firstly, I would be more mindful. I think more on the team side of things, I would definitely be more mindful of some of those challenges I spoke about around making sure that like just look at the people on your team and just invest a bit more time into that kind of getting everyone comfortable with this way of working, making sure that you have, you know, the skills on your team. And if not, accepting there'll be a bit of time to ramp up and get people confident with it. So kind of not really losing the fact that product brings a very special skill to that product trio. So if you don't have that, then being kind of mindful of team design and kind of leaving that time for learning. And then I think more on the applying the actual kind of practices of the book or the practices of continuous discovery. I think it's really bringing that kind of pragmatic mindset of like, okay, well, what is the stage of our company? What's our most critical? Like, what do we really need to learn? You know, where are we? What risks might we run into? Like some of those B2B risks of like reduced customers and kind of longer cadences for learning. And I think just applying a bit of critical thinking to like, you know, which aspects of this process or like what kind of discovery is going to be best for us at our current stage, which might not always be following the book to the letter, but just picking the things that are most appropriate for where you are and the sort of challenges you face.
And you mentioned maze.co, is it, that you used for gathering qual user insights. Were there any other tools that you came across that really, really helped you implement this process?
I suppose in terms of the qual research stack, yeah, on top of Maze, I really like Dovetail. That's one I've used in a few different roles. That's essentially just a really nice tool for consolidating all of your insights into one place. It makes it very easy to throw a video recording into there of a session, transcribe it, and then even sort of highlighting the interesting bits and extracting those into tagged up insights. I found it, and you can even kind of build these beautiful sort of story pages, which are very nice for like turning all the raw data of the interviews into like very digestible kind of summarized themes to kind of share out with the rest of the team. Super great platform. Supernormal is an AI note taker for calls that again is just so useful because you can just focus on doing the call and knowing that it's all been recorded and do your kind of transcription and summarization afterwards. I mean, there's a million note takers, take your pick, but I would definitely recommend having one. And then we're on the quant side of things. We use Mixpanel at Progression for our general sort of product analytics, and they have very good tools for sort of segmenting and doing A/B tests and all that sort of thing. It was great. We also use a little tool called Flipper, which basically lets teams self-serve in doing feature flagging. So essentially, if they were running an A/B test, you can just sort of set it all up, no code, switch on the winning experiment, switch on to more customers if you're not getting the traffic through it, and so on. So yeah, I think, yeah, on the quant and qual side, that was essentially our stack of useful tools.
Nice. We also use Flipper and Mixpanel. So yeah, it's interesting to hear other people using similar. Was there anything like in the process? Obviously, we talked about the kind of the struggles with, you know, quant and qual basically in that early stage startup mode. Was there anything else that, you know, you really struggled with in that process that would maybe make you hesitate to try and implement it again? Or
I can touch on a few of the challenges, or the, I kind of mentioned this in my blog post, and it's something I think the book kind of glosses over. It's like, what kind of company stage, or B2B versus B2C, what is this process most suitable for, or where might you find some challenges? For B2B and for early stage, there are a few I can kind of touch on. So I think for B2B, again, the idea that you're kind of always isolating these very small opportunities that are quite self-contained, shipping them rapidly in order to learn, I think that becomes a bit of a challenge in B2B, where you have these customers who, you know, they're onboarding onto the product. It's a big process for them. You know, they've already assessed your product, and to have it then changing, you know, kind of under their feet is quite unsettling. So I think for that kind of B2B customer, you do have to be respectful of the fact that, like, they've bought this product, their end users, you know, their employees are using it. And every time the product changes, we had a few of our customers getting quite stressed out, saying, like, is this feature staying? Is it coming? Is it going? You know, it feels a bit thin. So that idea of doing the smallest thing, I feel like it just can't always be the most appropriate to B2B. And I think what I mentioned before around that learning being a longer loop as well, and that kind of challenge in validating as well, it's all kind of connected. I can see how it would work, you know, at a Depop type company where you can just ship stuff, learn really quickly, turn it around. It's there or gone or shipped before the customer even knows. It's just a sort of different landscape in that way. And I think particularly at early stage, another challenge that I found there was, like, how do you really kind of isolate? I think the book touches on this, and I think it's a really important point. This outcome that you're kind of all rallying towards, the product team should be able to sort of independently own and influence it, you know, kind of accounting for external factors. So it's like finding that right metric that is, like, indicative of wider impact, but also, like, the product team can own it. That's really hard in early stage, and particularly pre-product market fit, because you might not know what those metrics are. It's almost like a whole company problem discovering that, you know, something can change from the outside that really kind of knocks it all sideways. So yeah, I definitely found it hard to sort of get the right balance there of, like, you know, still being open to, like, changing, you know, everything at, you know, from our sort of company vision, strategy, the shape of the product, while still giving the team sort of autonomy and ownership to kind of move smaller needle moving kind of things. It just felt like a bit of a disconnect there. I'm probably not describing it very well, but there's definitely a pain there of, like, in early stage, I just felt like it wasn't, you're kind of moving the dial on smaller features, and maybe you lose the wood for the trees of, have we even got product market fit, and, like, how do we pursue that? So there's definitely a tension there that I don't think the book fully covered how to kind of reconcile with that.
I think it's interesting, having worked similarly in very early stage startups, you know, they're often bred of a founder with an insight, a knowledge of the market. And quite often I find going with the instinct of the founder is the way you have to go, because you can't gather the data, or you can't, you know, nothing will give you, like, the concrete direction that you're looking for. So there is a lot of instinct born of knowledge and an understanding of the market. And I guess that's why, you know, a lot of startups fail, is because it's very hard to prove a concrete direction quickly enough for that.
Yeah. And I think a related risk is, when you're listening to your current customers, you're almost constrained by that version of your product with that product market fit for that segment. But you might be missing, well, we need to pivot a little bit more boldly for this new prospective segment or customer who we're not even talking to. But I think you're totally right. Like, founders can and should, I think, drive a lot of gut-led, you know, or sort of well-informed by the market, but like conviction that it's not really fair to like delegate that scale of decision-making down to a product squad. So yeah, I think it's that tension, certainly I felt that, yeah.
So I was just curious to know, after you went through a whole quarter of continuous discovery and implementing that and embedding that into the team's, I guess, kind of ways of working, you know, did you achieve the goals that you set out to achieve from a product outcome perspective? Did you feel like you made really good progress?
Yeah, great question. So as I mentioned at the top, we had that kind of dual objective that covered both the practices of becoming a team that cared about and actually worked in a way that centered customer discovery. And then we actually had our more like metric product impact measure. I would say definitely succeeded on the centering customers, you know, and we did keep up that cadence of trying to speak to customers as often as possible. And those were definitely practices that we rolled into subsequent quarters as well, with a bit more tweaking and calibrating to sort of address some of those issues. But like, I think we definitely became a more customer-centric company. So I'm giving myself a tick for that one. And we did move the needle on some product. So without getting into too much detail, essentially our product objective was around regular engagement with the product and retention and, yeah, basically teams using progression together much more regularly and getting value out of it. We did move the needle on some of those, what Teresa calls the leading metrics of like, okay, people are engaging and we have that assumption that that will ladder up into ultimate, you know, longer retention, higher customer value, and so on. In a quarter, it was pretty hard to prove out that correlation. So we were kind of moving the needle on the engagement side, but I think we definitely ran into challenges when it came to laddering that up to ultimately, have we achieved product market fit? Do we have customers who, you know, are loving the product much more? So partial success on that one, I would say.
And at the end of the quarter, did you continue to work in the same way, or did you move away from like a more strict, I guess, approach to continuous discovery?
Less strict, I would say. We almost kind of just immersed ourselves in it and kind of, you know, got ourselves in the habit. But then I think, as I said, it's kind of pulling back to what pragmatically worked for us, which is keeping the bits that work really well in terms of like being more customer centric, maintaining those Slack groups, maintaining product team direct access to customers, all of that great stuff, shipping early, you know, shipping more confidently. But tempering that with some of those challenges I mentioned around B2B of like making sure we were shipping enough packaged up value and communicating that to customers in a way that didn't feel overwhelming, casting the net wider of who we were talking to. So speaking to prospects as well as existing customers. So yeah, I would say we maintained a good balance, I think, of keeping the bits that work well for us and then sort of challenging and dismissing some of the ones that we felt like worked less well for our particular situation.
I feel like that's a... it's almost better to go all in and then pull back rather than sort of just like test the water around the edges and never like fully commit.
Yeah, I mean, Teresa does mention in the book, you know, start small, you know, start iterative. And what I really like about the book, actually, the last chapter, I don't know if she added it later, but there's all these case studies of teams who have like implemented continuous discovery, and nearly all of them start with like, it's just one product manager who had this problem and they started it within their teams. And then, you know, other teams were sort of curious and kind of looking in on the outside and seeing, oh, what are you doing there? Seems like this is working really well for you. So I can definitely see how like, starting small and like not making a huge thing of it, you know, doing that softly approach, particularly if you've got stakeholders who are a bit more cynical about changing up ways of working or delegating access to customers, just sort of showing that it's working in a lightweight way. But then for us, you know, because we had that buy-in, immersing ourselves in it and sort of overdoing it a bit and then being able to pull back, it worked well for us. So I can see how either could work.
So I think that's the perfect transition to what's probably our last question of the night, Katie. So for people who have listened to this, who have been inspired, who have been thinking about this for a while and want to introduce the idea of continuous discovery, given your experience, what would you give them as a piece of practical advice to help them get started?
I love a top three. I love an ABC, top three takeaways. So I think firstly, make sure you're taking that time to sort of build up your team's confidence and looking at who you have on the team and making sure that you're not going to be overwhelming people who've never been in front of a customer or, you know, a designer, so it shouldn't, you know, be fully accountable for like the whole stack of discovery. Look at who you have and make sure that you do build in that time, like accept that there's going to be a bit of a ramping up to this way of working if it's really new for your team. So accept that there's going to be a, you know, a sunk cost of just getting up and running and you can't expect great results straight away. I touched on it, you know, read the book, definitely, but then cherry pick what is most appropriate for your company stage and, you know, what you actually need from a discovery process. So sure, try doing what I did and kind of run it very strictly end to end, but then, yeah, make sure that you're continually reflecting on like what's working from this, what isn't working, picking and choosing essentially the bits, you know, that really work for you and what you really need in your company. And then the final one, I would say, make sure particularly as a product person, you're continually doing that kind of zoom out of like just making sure that you're not kind of getting stuck in these sort of local maximas of kind of small opportunities and little features that don't all hang together. Make sure that you are zooming out, looking at your whole product experience, looking at your strategy, looking at your product market fit and saying like, are we dreaming big enough here? You know, is this actually limiting us from, you know, going after a bigger opportunity? So yeah, I think those three things are definitely the three that stuck in my mind from going through this process that I'd want to take forward.
That's fantastic. That's really great advice. And yeah, it's obvious you've really went through this with intention, which is, I think, the really one of the key ways of adopting anything new like this. So thank you very much. This has been fantastic. I really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm really glad to, it was a while ago I wrote that post and even read the book. So I even kind of reread it in prep for this. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, you do a different reading once you've gone through it as well. So it's very nice for me to sort of, I always feel like every product person has that black box of, you know, mental models and things in their head. So for me, it was just another one to have in the back pocket.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you. This is great fun. Cheers.
The Product Experience is the first
and the best
podcast from Mind the Product. Our hosts are me, Lily Smith,
and me, Randy Silver.
Lou Ron Pratt is our producer and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arnie Kittler, who curates both Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and who also plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. You can connect with your local product community via Product Tank, regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, maybe you should think about starting one. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/product tank.